Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from Edvest and You, a loan product of the NEEF Network, a local nonprofit agency providing college student loans and student loan refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Here we are in midsummer, and in a normal presidential election year, we'd be talking about rallies, conventions, advertising, position papers, and speeches. But in 2020, the election has been overshadowed by an unprecedented health crisis and a national reckoning against racism in America. However, there is a campaign going on, even if the signs might be hard to find. And so today in The Exchange, we check in on the presidential race, how the candidates describe the enormous challenges the nation faces, and how they're trying to reach voters at a time when the usual handshaking and backslapping are not advised. Exchange listeners, we'd love to hear from you. What have you observed about this unusual presidential election year? Let us know. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. And our guests are Amy Walter, national editor of the Cook Political Report and host of Politics with Amy Walter on WNYC's The Takeaway. Also with us, Beatrice Peterson, 2020 producer and reporter for ABC News. Welcome to you both. And there is a ton to talk about. Amy, I'm going to start with you. In every election year around this time, we talk about how hard it is to get voters to pay attention in the summer. They're busy with vacations, distracted by summer activities. What about this year, Amy? How would you gauge Americans' attention right now on this presidential race?
It's a great question, and you're right. Normally, I would still be recovering from covering the Democratic convention, which was supposed to take place last week in Milwaukee.
I forgot about that. Okay.
Yeah. So we'd all still be sort of chatting about that and, you know, the speeches and who the vice presidential pick was and all those types of things. Obviously, that didn't happen. We are going to see some sort of convention. We don't know what it looks like at the end of August. Both parties. We are seeing, and we've noticed in polling.
And Amy, we're having a hard time with your line there, so I'm going to just hold off on you for a moment, and I do apologize for that. It's a remote world, and sometimes these things happen. Beatrice, what about you? How much are people paying attention, given everything else that is in front of them? It's just overwhelming.
You know, I think people are paying attention even more than normal. Unfortunately, due to coronavirus, people can't go out and about. They can't escape into movie theaters. They're not watching new programming. There's some new television that's on, but not a lot. And so people are really in tune on what's going on in the country now. I regularly still am out doing my coverage, and I meet people all the time who tell me, like, this is the first time that they've ever been engaged with politics so closely. A lot of people are watching this election and are making decisions. And a lot of the Black Lives Matter protests as well are actually planning on being first time voters. So there is a lot more engagement, I think, now just due to coronavirus than there was probably in a while.
That's interesting. And, you know, again, in a normal year, Beatrice, we talk about people are busy with their summer vacations. A lot of us aren't really taking summer vacations this year, so maybe we have more time to pay attention to the presidential race. You mentioned your coverage, Beatrice, and I know you've been covering the Biden campaign. You went to the Trump Tulsa rally. You were supposed to be covering the Portsmouth rally here in New Hampshire, but that got canceled. What's it been like for you as a political reporter? Normally, you know, I would imagine you jetting around the country and covering all these events. What's that been like, Beatrice?
Well, it's a stark difference. I mean, just last year, I was traveling around the country. I lived in New Hampshire to Roberts campaign. So I love the state very much. But, it was not uncommon for me in New Hampshire one day and in South Carolina the next, or Iowa. Now travel is a lot different. It's a lot more methodical. There are a lot of detail that goes into traveling. The candidates are not out and about just bopping around and having a rally at the last minute. They're actually going to plan the rallies out 7-10 days in advance so they can think about social distancing and a lot of different other measures. Is the venue has enough space to accommodate 50% capacity? Those are a lot of thoughts that have to go through for the campaigns now. And campaigns are different. I was in Tulsa. Tulsa was interesting. You had people there who were requested to wear masks, strongly encouraged, but a lot of them didn't. And they were very adamant that they were not going to wear masks. But however, when I was in New Hampshire, and I spoke to voters at the what would have been the Trump rally in Portsmouth, a number of voters told me that they were going to wear very for them. So it's interesting. There's a, it's not a traditional, you know, campaign cycle. If you had said to me 6 months ago that you would go to a campaign event and people would hand out masks, hand sanitizer, I would be very confused. But yeah, this is the world we live in.
Well, we've got some callers up, so let's go to them. And I want to remind listeners that as we talk about this year's presidential campaign, which is definitely an odd one, if I could call it that, we want to hear from you what you've observed about this campaign year and what questions you have about how the candidates are campaigning, what they're saying. Our phone number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-6477, or send us an email. It's exchange@nhpr.org. And let's take a call. This is Jack from Manchester. Hi, Jack. You're on the exchange. Welcome. Thanks for calling in.
Good morning. Good to talk to you. The dean, I guess, of talk show hosts or hostesses in New Hampshire.
And, thank you, Jack.
Doing a great job at it. I just discovered this morning that probably the biggest name in punditocracy, George F. Will, has endorsed and said he will vote for Joe Biden for president. And as someone who's been a George Will fan for more than 40 years, I find this very disappointing because, this is the same columnist who years ago wrote against the idea that every institution must be broken to the saddle of the state. Great wordsmith George Will is. But anyway, and yet now he's endorsing and will vote for the candidate that wants to force the Little Sisters of the Poor to either provide contraceptive coverage for their employees against their religious beliefs or face ruinous fines that will put them out of business. And I can't imagine how putting the Little Sisters of the Poor out of business is going to make the country any better.
Talking about the exceptions for, the debate over whether religiously affiliated organizations need to provide contraceptive coverage and that whole debate. And Jack, I'm glad you called because we should talk about this, Beatrice, how Republicans are sometimes splitting over the president. We heard from Jack that George Will, a very prominent Republican columnist, says he's going to vote for Joe Biden. Are these significant numbers, Beatrice, or just sort of a couple prominent disgruntled intellectuals?
I think it's too early to tell. I covered the Never Trump movement in 2016, and at that point, it was a small kind of niche group that wasn't, didn't have enough power to overtake President Donald Trump's bid for the Republican nomination. Some of the more prominent members of the Never Trump movement, I remember very starkly Ken Cuccinelli, who is now a part of President Trump's cabinet. So it's interesting. Now you see a lot more prominence. You have groups like the Lincoln Project, who have really stake their claim and stake their presence and may their presence be known. I just had a conversation yesterday with one of the Never Trump activists or organizers, if you want to call that. And they're planning actually a more robust defense against why people shouldn't vote for the president, which is really interesting. I do think that there is a little bit of a shift now. People who, I've met a number of people just over the past year or so who maybe voted for President Trump in 2016, but may be undecided on who they want to vote for in 2020. So those voters are really up for grabs. You know, do they continue the path to vote for the president for re-election? Do they go for Joe Biden? We don't know yet. However, I think right now, I think the campaigns, both Democrats and Republicans, as well as the third party campaigns, they have to figure out how do you reach voters in ways that are so untraditional because they're not able to go outside in the way that they used to. They're not going to be really receptive to traditional door knocking. Some people will, but most Americans won't, especially as we strive towards social distancing. So,
right. Who knocks on the door these days? I mean, somebody knocks on the door now and you go, whoa, who's that? I didn't order a pizza. So, you know, Amy Walter is back with us. And Amy, sorry about your line there.
No, we
were talking with Beatrice about, you know, how she's been covering this campaign. Normally she'd be flying around the country, attending this rally and, you know, that voter outreach event. What has it been like for you covering this? Again, given that we're all sort of supposed to stay put.
Yeah, it is very different. In some ways, it does make it much more challenging. I would really have loved to have been in Milwaukee, not necessarily for the convention, but because Wisconsin's a swing state, and I could have spent the time that we weren't covering what was going on inside the convention center, actually out and about in the places, the cities and the towns that are going to decide the presidential election, right? Talking to voters and seeing how the campaigns are organizing there. So that would have been a great opportunity that I just do not have now. But what I also know is that how voters interact with the political process is very different now because politics and government is impacting them today in a way that it didn't a year ago, 6 months ago. And that is how they are responding, whether it's your governor, your state, and of course the federal government, to this coronavirus pandemic. You are now tuned in, if you're a parent, very closely to what your local school district is talking about doing this fall, whether or not a vaccine may be on the way, what the president is saying or not saying about wearing masks, about the safety of opening up our government, how well they seem to be handling the health and economic consequences of this pandemic. And so, interestingly enough, I do think politics is breaking through in a way that it wasn't before because it is literally now a life or death reality. And the same you mentioned in the opening about the reckoning, the racial and social reckoning that's happening in this country after the death of George Floyd, obviously the protests that have continued in many cities across this country. And again, this is something that has broken through for voters in a way that is unprecedented. And I do think the fact that we are all in our homes, we are not traveling, we are not distracted by our normal sort of what our lives were before the pandemic, means we are spending a lot more time talking and thinking and watching these things.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And that reflects what Beatrice said too, Amy. And she said she's met people at these protests who say they'll be first time voters. So people are really feeling these issues directly in their lives. and that's making them pay more attention. That's really interesting. We heard earlier too, Amy, from Jack in Manchester. And Jack, thank you again for calling. And I wasn't sure if you were back with us, Amy, at that point. I'd love your thoughts. Jack is a longtime conservative Republican, very upset with George Will, who says he will vote for Joe Biden. And I asked Beatrice, and I'd like to ask you too, Amy, what you think about this Never Trumper movement. You know, I asked Beatrice, is it just a couple disgruntled intellectuals like George Will, or is this a real thing?
Well, I think it really depends on what your definition of Republican is and Never Trumper is. They're certainly the most high profile members, as you pointed out. These are, you know, public intellectuals, George Will, Bill Kristol, and others who have made it clear for some time now their disappointment in Donald Trump and the Republicans in Congress who continue to support him. But when you look at since 2017, where voters have expressed their displeasure with President Trump, where maybe traditionally more Republican-leaning voters have expressed their displeasure, is in the suburbs, in suburbs that for years and years and years were considered Republican strongholds, like Orange County, California. That is one of the most Republican places in the state of California. And in 2018, every single one of their congressional districts flipped to Democrats. We saw, again, this in Dallas and Atlanta, very solidly Republican suburbs turning toward Democrats. The question in my mind isn't so much whether they vote again against the president. I think they will. It's whether this is a permanent shift, that these suburban voters now are realigned into the Democratic coalition, or whether this is sort of a one-time thing, right? If Trump's not in the White House, these voters maybe go back to their ancestral place of Republicanship and gravitate more to Republican candidates. We don't know yet, but it is pretty consequential the ways in which the president has alienated what is a really critical group of voters for his party. It certainly cost them the House in 2018. And right now, it's what is really putting his reelection in peril.
I'd like to ask both of you about suburban voters and the focus on those voters and other voter groups this time around. But let's go back to our listeners. Again, our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email. We'd love your observations on this odd presidential election year. And as both our guests say, a lot of Americans are paying more attention than they normally would during the summer. If that's the situation with you, again, we'd love to hear from you. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Beatrice and Amy, another caller. Russell is on the line from Meredith. Hi, Russell. You're on the air. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning, and thank you for having me on.
Sure. Go ahead, Russell.
So I may lose you. I may lose you somewhere in here, but I'm a staunch Democrat. I don't mind saying it. All my family pretty much is Republican, but that's okay. We get along. I can't believe our president, if I dare call him that, is really doing what he's doing. I just can't understand why he thinks we need martial law or whatever you want to call it in our cities. I think it's a racial bias targeting Chicago. I believe their mayor is a black female. And I just don't get it. I'm a veteran of 30 years and a combat vet, and I just don't get it. I don't understand why we have this man.
Well, Russell, thank you for calling in, and sort of a counterpart to Jack, who called in earlier. And Beatrice, we should talk about what Russell mentioned. That is not just the current debate over sending in federal forces to some American cities, but this broader movement, you know, really striking out against racial injustice in this country and a long history of racism. How do you see this affecting the presidential campaign, Beatrice? And I apologize because we could do a whole hour on this topic, but go ahead. I'd love your thoughts there.
I think it's going to, it's playing out right now. I mean, there are, I think about this often. I was in New Hampshire for the Trump rally that didn't happen. And after it was canceled, I went and got some food and went to see some of my favorite establishments that have some of the, I think, the greatest food in the country, if you ask me. But I was in a shop in Nashua, and I had went to talk to folks for a brief bit, just socially distant, you know, say, hey, what are you thinking about things right now? And I think about this, actually, I think about it every day. A woman that I knew very well in New Hampshire, she pulled me aside and said to me, she said, you know, Beatrice, you know, I'm not political, but right now I'm really invested in the election. I vote, but you know, I just vote for who I like. I don't necessarily vote on, you know, a party platform or issue. I just vote on my gut. And she pulled me aside and said to me, she said, Beatrice, you know, things have shifted in this country in a way that I'm now supporting Joe Biden. She's a Joe Biden supporter. She said that, you know, she wanted him to pick an African-American vice president. She's a 34-year-old white woman who wanted a Black woman as the VP. She said, I will not vote for Joe Biden if he does not have a Black woman, because we need somebody to speak to the issues of racial injustice and the racial uprising in this country. And it really struck me because, you know, I've spoken to her many times. She and I have talked about an African-American, she's white, and we've talked about race a lot. And before this, you know, race was in the background, but for her, she treated everyone the same regardless of color. But in this instance, in this moment, color is really important. And, you know, I don't know how it's going to play out just yet. I mean, things change quickly. But these protests are continuing. A lot of the activists who have been organizing the protests, I've been speaking to regularly, who've told me that they plan on protesting into the winter, regardless of who's in the White House. And even if, you know, perhaps a Joe Biden is in the White House or someone progressive, they still plan on holding them accountable. And it doesn't matter about party affiliation or anything on that matter.
Really interesting. And Amy, I got to ask you this too. And again, as I said to Beatrice, apologies because it's a huge question. We could talk about it for the whole hour. But how do you see this whole movement that started in mid-May, with the killing of George Floyd, and has continued and continued, and now, as our caller referenced, we're seeing unrest in some cities, federal forces going in. How is this just affecting the whole mood or theme or narrative of this presidential campaign, Amy?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are three things that have affected the 2020 race and the trajectory of this race. One, obviously, the coronavirus. Two, as we're discussing right now, the killing of George Floyd and the aftermath of that. And then the third, which we'll get to, I'm sure, at some point, is the fact that Joe Biden and not Bernie Sanders won the Democratic nomination for president. Those three things, when we look back, we will say that's what really charted the course for this election. You know, I thought that I don't know what the right word, poignant, I guess, is the right word here, bittersweet, in the tributes to John Lewis that came in over the weekend. Of course, the Democratic congressman, longtime civil rights leader. We hear a lot about that infamous march to Selma and what happened on the bridge there. And when you talk to John Lewis about that and others who covered it, they said that it was at that moment when those images were broadcast around the world, when TV cameras were there capturing innocent people getting bludgeoned by police officers, that the fight for civil rights in the country changed, where white Americans' eyes were literally opened to the realities that so many African Americans had been living and you couldn't go back after that. There was no way that things were going to, quote unquote, get back to normal. And I think that's what's happening now for so many Americans who had been, again, white Americans, who had become aware of police discrimination, violence, and, of course, discrimination writ large against African-Americans. But it was sort of background noise. Now that was brought to the fore, and it's not going to go back again. We're also seeing that white Americans, over just the last couple of months, their opinions about everything from the Confederate flag or statues, the Black Lives Matter movement, racism in the country, has, it's not been a 180-degree change, but it has been a significant change. And so, yes, this is with us for quite some time now. And I think, as we saw in the 1960s, there is a tremendous amount of momentum here. And where it goes, we don't know exactly. But we can certainly see how, in the next year or two, calls for, whether it's just at the local level for police reforms or at the national level for reauthorizing the Voting Rights Act and other issues like this, are going to become front and center.
Well, really interesting. And after a short break, I want to pick up on what you just said there, Amy. In addition to the importance of the racial justice movement and obviously coronavirus, you said that the third important factor to consider is the fact that Joe Biden won the Democratic nomination, not Bernie Sanders. So let's pick up on that thread after a short break. And Exchange listeners, it's been great to hear from you. We'd love your thoughts, questions, comments about this unusual presidential election year. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or you can give us a call at 1-800-892-6777, and we'll be right back. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. It's a presidential year, and we're looking at this race occurring in a climate we've never seen before. We're asking how the candidates are talking about the enormous challenges our nation faces and how they're trying to reach voters at a time when large gatherings and person-to-person contact is not advised. Exchange listeners, what have you observed about this presidential campaign? How do you see it playing out? Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We're talking with Amy Walter, national editor of the Cook Political Report and host of Politics with Amy Walter on WNYC's The Takeaway. Also with us, Beatrice Peterson, 2020 producer and reporter for ABC News. One more time, that email is exchange@nhpr.org. And Beatrice, I'd love your thoughts on what Amy said just before the break. We here, of course, with the New Hampshire primary, and both of you here were up here covering it. And at the time, Amy's so right. The story was, who is going to win this nomination, and what will that say about, you know, this presidential race? And for a while, Bernie Sanders seemed to be, you know, definitely holding a strong position. What about that, Beatrice? The fact that it is Joe Biden, as Amy said, and not Bernie Sanders who won the nomination?
Well, you know, I think Joe Biden has to make, he's been making inroads, I think, with progressives. He has been holding these task force on different issues, part of the Bernie Biden task force. They actually just put a series of very lengthy series of policy platforms that they agreed on, from people who, ranging from AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the representative from New York, to people like John Kerry, who served on the same committee talking about climate change. I spoke to a number of people who served on the Sanders-Biden Unity Task Force, and I asked them, you know, hey, how is this process? You know, did you guys feel that your voices were being heard? And these are people who are very progressive and very, what I guess we would consider blue dog Democrat, so to speak. And it was interesting. They felt as if, I spoke to a number of people on different panels, they felt as if they were actually being heard and they actually came to a consensus. They submitted their recommendations to the DNC, and we'll see if that becomes a part of the DNC's party platform going forward. But, you know, there were things that were on these, that came out of the platform committee recommendations that were very interesting. You had carbon neutrality on there, but you also didn't have things that were synonymous with Sanders' campaign. There was no Medicare for all. There was no marijuana. So, you know, there was interesting. So things came out of it, but, you know, the question is, you know, has the party shifted left? I believe so. Has the whole party shifted left? I don't think so.
That's interesting. And Vice President Mike Pence talked about this. They have been delivering a theme that Joe Biden and the Democratic Party have gone too far left, what they call the radical left. Let's hear a little bit from the vice president delivering a speech in Wisconsin and casting the upcoming election as a very stark choice.
Before us are two paths, one based on the dignity of every individual, and the other on the growing control of the state. Our road leads to greater freedom and opportunity. Their road leads to socialism and decline. President Trump set our nation on a path to freedom and opportunity from the very first day of this administration. But Joe Biden would set America on a path of socialism and decline.
So there you go, Amy Walter, socialism and decline. And that's definitely invoking, you know, the Bernie Sanders wing of the party. What do you think?
Well, it's going to be a challenge for the Trump campaign to really make that stick. Now, I think among hardcore Republicans, this is a message that resonates. And I do think that you see this message also echoed in conservative media circles, Fox News and other places. So this message is as much about keeping the Republican Party unified as anything else. And obviously, over these last few weeks, as we've seen the toll that the coronavirus pandemic has taken on people's feelings of safety, on the economic situation in the country, and of course on their health, you know, you've seen some softening of the president's numbers among Republicans. So I think this message, in that sense, is very helpful to bringing everybody back into the fold, the Republicans back into the fold. As for a message for swing voters, for voters who are trying to decide who to vote for in this election, it strikes me as kind of a difficult message to stick. Joe Biden can be many things, but a radical left is not one of those things that most people attach to him. And as I said earlier, you know, the fact that he ran in the primary against many of the proposals that the more liberal candidates in the race had been proposing, as Beatrice talked about, Medicare for all, legalizing marijuana, breaking up big tech. Those were the sorts of things that you heard from Elizabeth Warren and from Bernie Sanders. You never heard from Joe Biden. He gets a lot of criticism, and we heard this during the primary as well, from the left that he's not gone far enough on many of these issues. And so tagging him as some sort of socialist wannabe is going to be tough. What they're doing instead, and you hear the president saying this a lot, is, well, maybe Joe Biden himself isn't so far left, but he's going to be surrounded by people who are. And by the way, he's old and he's not quite 100% with it, and he can be easily manipulated. He will just be a puppet and a pawn for those who want to move our country very far to the left. Again, I just think two things are a problem. One, it's, you know, again, Joe Biden really doesn't fit the stereotype of a leftist. And the other is that President Trump is not a particularly good messenger here. For voters who are maybe not 100% sold on Joe Biden, they also don't see President Trump as somebody who is doing a particularly good job on unifying America. They don't necessarily trust the way he's handled life in the post-pandemic, post-protest era. So that becomes a real problem as well. And finally, look, I think this is an effective argument if Democrats were the ones in charge, if this were a Democratic-controlled government and we had these protests and we had all these sorts of things happening and proposals put out there by the party in control of government. But it's not Democrats. It's Republicans. So it is basically telling voters, well, I know you don't like what you see right now, but trust us, it's going to be even worse when Biden's in office.
So the Trump campaign saying Joe Biden is, and this is a quote I saw from the campaign yesterday, an auto pen for the radical left, again, using Vice President Pence's words there. So that's the main theme, you know, socialism, chaos in our cities. The president has been talking about that this week. Beatrice, what about the Biden campaign? If you had to summarize sort of that message in a sentence or two, what's the theme coming from that campaign?
Well, they've been releasing different pillars of their Build Back Better message. You know, the campaign is trying to counter a lot of the things that the president is currently doing. I mean, that's why when you go, you watch television, you see Biden on the stage, he sometimes is coming out to the press events with a mask on. He's taking pictures with masks on. He's observing social distance. He's really trying to make his message a counter to what the last 4 years has been, and also kind of evoking the time that he was in the White House with President Obama, saying that it's kind of like a throwback to what has been in the past. He's right now pushing out a lot of pillars on the economy, on elder care, and a lot of different messages on climate change as well, which is a shift because, you know, to say that Joe Biden would be talking about climate change 6 months ago, it's a big difference in acknowledging the difference of the party diversity, so to speak, that came out of the 20-person Democratic primary field. He's taken some of the top talent that came out of these campaigns and have added them to his staff, and are taking some of the ideas that came out of the various campaigns that were popular with voters, but not popular enough to get that said candidate to be the nominee, but he's taking those ideas, to build his coalition, so to speak, which is why the Bernie Sanders, Joe Biden Unity Task Force and the Unity message and platform is really important. It's not uncommon to see a Zoom call with Pete Buttigieg, so to speak, or Senator Kamala Harris, or Amy Klobuchar. You're seeing the top talent that came out of 2020 uniting behind the presumptive Democratic nominee.
Oh, that's interesting. And I have to say, you know, Beatrice, listening to you bring up some of the names from that 2020 Democratic presidential race that we saw so closely here in New Hampshire, it seems like a million thousand trillion years ago. So much has changed since then. But you're right, that does happen during a big primary. The eventual nominee sort of pulls in ideas and the best energy from the other candidates. Since you mentioned climate, Beatrice, I do want to play a little bit from Joe Biden giving a speech on clean energy and infrastructure. And here he says, if he is elected, he will tackle what he calls the onrushing climate crisis. Let's hear.
Left unchecked, it is literally an existential threat to the health of our planet and to our very survival. That's not up for dispute, Mr. President. When Donald Trump thinks about climate change, the only word he can muster is hoax. When I think about climate change, the word I think of is jobs. good pain, union jobs.
All right. And again, that's Joe Biden talking about climate. A couple emails have come in as we talk about the presidential race and how odd it is this year, but how Americans, our guests tell us, are paying a lot of attention. Karen writes in from Laconia, I see it as a good thing that the Democratic candidate is Biden in terms of bringing in Republicans who are disappointed with Trump, Karen says. He represents stability and civility, whereas Bernie represents radicalism to these voters. Karen says, I'm hoping that this will offset those who will vote only for Bernie. So Karen, thank you for writing. And Ken writes, how plausible is it for the Electoral College to select the Republican candidate this fall, regardless of the popular vote? Ken says, I'm a Bethlehem, New Hampshire resident and New Hampshire Army National Guard, retired disabled combat veteran. Ken says, I voted for Al Gore, Bob Dole, Mike Huckabee. I try to pick the best option. Ken, it's great to hear from you. Karen, you too. After a break, I do want to ask you about the Electoral College and whether you see this as a national election, air quotes there, or more as an Electoral College election where candidates are really focusing on those states where presidential bids have been won and lost. We have seen this before. We'll talk about that after a break. Keep those emails coming, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. This hour, campaigning for president in unprecedented times amid a nationwide racial justice movement and an ongoing pandemic. President Trump and presumptive Democratic nominee Joe Biden are having to adapt, and we're finding out how this hour. And Exchange listeners, it's been really great to hear from you. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Tell us how you're observing this unusual presidential year. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can comment on Facebook or you can give us a call at 1-800-892-6477. And Amy Walter and Beatrice Peterson, I want to get both of your thoughts on a really interesting email from Ken that I read just before the break. And Amy, basically, he was asking, how much is this election going to be a national event that concerns the whole country? And how much is it about that Electoral College map and, you know, getting over that magic number of Electoral College votes? Go ahead, Amy.
Right. Well, I think we learned in 2016 that the Electoral College, of course, is where it's at. And in, I think, this year, we are also recognizing that the national mood is having an impact on the Electoral College and on voters across the spectrum. So look, there's no doubt that this is still a race in individual states. There are some states, I'm sorry to say, that are going to be pretty well ignored, as they usually are in a presidential election year.
Such as?
And some states that are going to get a ton of attention. So if you're living in Wisconsin or Arizona or Michigan, you're going to get a lot more advertising than you are if you live, say, in Utah or Idaho or New Jersey. But look, I think what has happened over these last few months here, we went from an election where the president was starting off in not a bad place, but not a great place. He had failed to hit more than about 48% in his job approval rating. He was basically sitting in January of this year in kind of the same place he was going into the election of 2016, which was he wasn't popular broadly across the nation, but you could see the case that he could make in enough individual states where he could once again, say, lose the popular vote, even by a bigger margin, but still hold the Electoral College by holding on to some of those places in the upper Midwest, like Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Michigan. Now where we are, of course, is we're looking at a time in which the national mood has changed dramatically. Opinions of the president have soured considerably across the board, even in states where he had been really much more popular, like Ohio or Indiana. And that is taking a tremendous toll on his ability to put together those 270 electoral votes. New Hampshire is a great example of this. Look, this was one of the closest states in the country in 2016. Hillary Clinton barely held on to win here. But since then, you just haven't seen much campaigning, whether virtually or not, by the campaigns, in part because the president's overall ratings in states that he lost have dropped even more soundly and more significantly than in places that he carried or narrowly carried. So the short answer is yes, it is still an electoral college map, and that's what will always matter. But the deterioration in the national environment is what is making things very challenging for the president in trying to win 270 electoral votes.
Beatrice, how do you see those calculations being made as someone who is out traveling? You know, we mentioned earlier you went to the Trump rally in Tulsa and the rally that was going to take place here in New Hampshire. You've been covering the Biden campaign. How do you see both of these candidates taking that electoral college map in mind as they decide where to spend money and where to go?
Well, you know, I do agree with Amy. The mood in the country has really shifted things. There are not traditional campaign events for right now where you have the thousands of people lined up in the stadium or wherever.
Right.
You're not seeing that anymore, but you are seeing these teleconference options. The president had several hyperlocal ones over the weekend. I think he had about five of them. The Biden campaign is hosting a lot of Zoom calls. Sometimes he's on it, sometimes surrogates are on it. There is a push, though, in certain states that traditionally may have not gotten as much attention from Democrats, where they see a possible avenue to turn a state purple. So I'm thinking states like Arizona. Biden has just announced a new team in Texas. I've spoken to a lot of the Texas Democrats who are raising money left and right and are planning on organizing at their local grocery store because that's where people are.
That's the one place everybody's still going. Sure. Go ahead, Beatrice.
Grocery store organizing. But, you know, it's interesting. I do think it's hard to do what we did in the past where we had these big campaign events. So the campaigns are trying to reinvent themselves. So it is now having the president talk on the phone to voters in X state, or it is Biden having a pre-recorded or live Zoom call. So it's a little bit different now. The campaigning, I do think, is electorally base, but you know, I mean, people are tuning in. You may be in New Mexico, but you're listening to what the president's saying and about Arizona, your neighboring state. So it's everyone's kind of looking and seeing what is the news of the day and, you know, how it affects them. And I think they're using that to make a decision on who they plan on supporting.
Kind of what you said earlier, right at the beginning, Beatrice, people are super tuned in because there are these, you know, events in front of us concerning our communities, concerning our own personal health. So it's really interesting to hear that people actually more tuned in than they might have been in summers past. And the Trump campaign announced just recently, just as we talk about, you know, the electoral college strategies and so forth, Women for Trump is going to do a bus tour through New Hampshire and Maine with a dinner and some roundtable discussions. So that feels like a little bit of sort of the old fashioned swing state campaigning there. We only have a couple minutes left, and I really, really want to ask both of you about the conventions. And Amy, to you first, because you mentioned at the beginning of the show, normally this time you would be talking about the convention and the follow-up from that and who the vice presidential pick was and so on and so forth. And Beatrice, Amy mentioned earlier, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, swing state, the Democratic convention is, quote, anchored there, Beatrice. So what does that mean, anchored in Milwaukee? Not in Milwaukee, but anchored in Milwaukee.
Well, there are not too many details that have been released publicly, but we do know that a number of delegates have been asked not to travel to Milwaukee. You know, traditionally it'd be thousands of people. You know, people I know who are in the party were planning on staying out as far as close to Chicago and commuting into Milwaukee because they were expecting the hotels to be packed with people. And now there's going to be less of an impact. You're going to probably see a lot more Zoom calls, as we're seeing now on television. You know, delegates who may not, you're not going to see the delegations of 500 people showing up to Milwaukee. You maybe see one person, if that. So it's interesting. It's going to be a clear shift, at least in Milwaukee. But, you know, the Republican side, they have switched their convention. It initially was supposed to be in Charlotte, North Carolina, and now it's going to be in Jacksonville. And the Never Trumpers, back to them, they're planning counter programming against the RNC's mission so they can put out their own platform, trying to give voters who are conservative an alternate programming or mission or purpose or whatever you want to call it against the president, because they're Never Trumpers, but they are conservatives. A number of them are supporting now Joe Biden, and they're asking fellow conservatives to support Joe Biden because they do not align with the president's values. So it's interesting to see a shift.
That is really interesting and made or happening in part, Beatrice, correct me if I'm wrong, by the fact that these conventions are kind of virtual, that there isn't this sort of crowd of thousands.
Yeah, the virtual aspect changes a lot of different things. And, you know, previously to get some of the Never Trump sentiment, sometimes you would have to be in location. You have to be on the ground. I remember seeing a number of Never Trumpers at the RNC in Cleveland in 2016. And I got a full presence of that there, but I don't think a lot of the people at home got it because there were so many things going on. You had the protest outside the convention. You had the Never Trump movement inside the convention. You had pro-Trump inside the convention. Now, people who are looking for the Never Trump movement, they can look at a tweet or click a link. It's a lot different than previous years.
Amy, what about you? You mentioned earlier that the convention is anchored in quotes in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And I heard the disappointment in your voice when you told us that, because, you know, conventions are like Christmas for political reporters, right? So are Americans going to tune into this thing, Amy? I mean, most of us usually watch it on television anyway, but without the political theater, is it going to be worth watching?
Right. I mean, listen, as political reporters, we've all been questioning for years whether these conventions are actually a relic that need to be just sort of moved out, put out to pasture, so to speak. And this may be sort of the way in which our conventions are changed forever and maybe permanently. But look, I think for Joe Biden, the stakes are pretty high in that we just haven't seen a lot of Joe Biden, right? A lot of it is because of the way that he cannot campaign. A lot of it is because we're in the middle of a pandemic. And a lot of it is because the president himself does not like to cede the spotlight. He wants to be the center of news attention each and every day. Doesn't give a lot of oxygen for anyone or anything else to break into that. But this is the first chance that voters are going to get to see what Joe Biden will look like in the, you know, can sort of picture him as president. He has to pick a vice president, obviously. How he connects with that person, how he makes that decision, who that person is, will say a lot about the way that he makes critical decisions and could make critical decisions as president. So all of those are going to be this really key opportunity for the public to get a sense of Joe Biden in a way that Joe Biden, of course, wants them to. The debates are really the first time where they will see Joe Biden up against Donald Trump and sort of pressed on a lot of the issues and challenges ahead for the public. So these two events for Biden, I think, are critical he has a lead right now, but in order to keep up that lead, he needs to look as if he can easily step into the role of president and doesn't raise more questions in the minds of voters about whether he's able to do this job and how he will process the problems in front of us.
Well, we haven't had a chance yet to talk about the Republican convention still being held in person in Florida, whether the fact that now Florida is a hotspot for coronavirus, whether that will change the convention. I'd love to have both of you back, actually, after these conventions so we can hash out what happened and where the race goes from here. For now, though, we've got to wrap it up. Amy, it was really great to have you back on the show. Thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome, Laura. Thank you.
That's Amy Walter, national editor of the Cook Political Report, and Beatrice Peterson. I hope we have you back, too. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Beatrice Peterson, 2020 producer and reporter for ABC News, and you've been listening to The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Stitcher for NHPR Exchange.